From the studios of KPCW in Park City, it's This Green Earth, a weekly talk show about the environment and our connections with it. I'm Nell Larson.
And I'm Chris Cherniak.
Happy to have you back, Chris.
It's good to be back. We're
back here in rainy Park City.
Practically snowing after spending 2 weeks in muggy Florida.
You're prepared for this, then.
Yes.
Well, at 9:15 today, we'll be speaking with Alex Terrell. He's the deputy director at League of Conservation Voters. He'll be giving us the latest on Bears Ears National Monument in light of the report that Secretary of the Interior Ryan Zinke submitted to President Trump on Saturday with his recommendations for the area right here in Utah.
Then in the second part of the show, we'll speak with Lisa Yoder. She's Sustainability Director for Summit County. She'll share with us some of the programs, projects, and initiatives the county will pursue with respect to sustainability, electricity, natural gas, fuel, and water. That's all in the second part of the show.
We also have some updates for you, some highlights from the environmental world. Highlights or lowlights, as it may be this week.
Of course, while I was in Florida, I got an interesting news item. The state of Florida is planning on hiring more python hunters within the Everglades. So kids, if you're looking for a summer job, want to work outdoors and make sort of big money, then you need to stay tuned for that story.
Perfect.
We don't take phone calls during the show, but you can join in on today's discussion by posting your comments and questions to our Facebook page, Facebook to KPCW's This Green Earth. Our connections with and impacts upon the environment, that's what This Green Earth is all about, so stay with us.
Support of KPCW comes from Zions Bank Family Business Services. Zions Bank, we haven't forgotten who keeps us in business. More information available online at zionsbank.com.
This is Steve Roney with Berkshire Hathaway Home Services Utah Properties. We continue to be proud supporters of KPCW, our local source for Park City news. Our agents are Summit and Wasatch County's source for real estate, and we can be reached at bhhsutah.com.
Welcome to This Green Earth, a weekly talk show on environmental issues and concepts of sustainability. I'm Chris Cherniak.
I'm Nell Larson.
And yeah, it's good to be back after a couple of weeks in Florida. Florida always has some unique environmental issues, one being the Burmese python and its route basically that it is put on in the Everglades. And we'll get to that story later in the show. But we have our own little this is more of a native species.
That's
issues
right.
Associated with that and how it impacts land conservation, preservation, land development.
Yeah.
And what is it?
The sage grouse.
The sage grouse.
So we've talked about the sage grouse before quite a bit. You know, I feel like a couple times a year we kind of give an update. There was thought that the sage grouse was going to be listed as an endangered species.
Right.
Because it's lost so much habitat and its population has dropped about like 90% over the past, I think it's 25 years.
I'll have
to check that stat here. And along with protecting the sage grouse, you protect the entire community with it, like you alluded to, not only the sage, you know, the sagebrush itself, but all of the plants and animals that come along with it.
So it's a keystone species in that sense.
It is. And it really... you know, I think those sagebrush habitats look like just a sea of nothing but sagebrush, but they're actually one of the most diverse in this area. So,
where do we stand with it?
So the Fish and Wildlife Service determined that this, you know, this sage grouse should not be listed as an endangered species because there was a range-wide effort by the federal agencies and states to conserve the bird. I mean, everybody worked together. It was this federal-level collaboration. And because of that plan, it wasn't listed. It was kind of touted as a big success in certain circles. And Zinke has just kind of reopened that On the 8th of this month, he issued an order establishing a federal panel to review both federal and state efforts to protect the greater sage grouse and to identify provisions that may require modification depending on their potential effects on energy extraction.
Oh, really?
Yeah. So it kind of comes back to how is this impacting, you know, the energy industry's energy extraction on, in many cases, public lands.
Right. The construction, installation, exploration for oil and natural gas.
And basically. Operation, right?
Operation, I mean, yeah. So will the sage grouse get in the way of that?
Mm-hmm. And will the protection of the sage grouse, yeah.
I.e. the sage grouse get in the way in, at the end of the day? Will it be in the way of our efforts to extract oil and natural gas? So Zinke, who's the head of the Department of Interior, is reviewing that situation. That matter. Okay.
Yeah, he ordered the federal agencies to look at that. The National Greater Sage Grouse Planning Strategy, as they call it, will cost more than $45 million, and it will conserve hundreds of fish and wildlife species, support a $1 billion recreation economy, and provide for multiple use on public lands in 11 western states where you find the sage grouse. So, you know, this plan, while it's targeted on the sage grouse, it will have so many other benefits as well to the environment and recreation and
economic externalities associated with it. Mm-hmm. But one of those impacts might be to the oil and natural gas industry. So that's what Ryan Zinke wants to explore.
Right.
And see what impacts it has upon them.
And, of course, the environmental groups are already popping up with the studies they've done in the past about impacts of energy development on sage grouse. You know, it's declined 2.5% per year.
Right.
And, you know, X amount is due to energy development. And so I think that that'll be an interesting thing to watch.
Okay.
Over the next several months.
All right. Well, real quick, while we're waiting for Alex Terrell from League of Conservation Voters call in. Along those same lines, the EPA just announced a deferral of the setting of the 2015 standards for ozone pollution. We can get it more into that later in the show. But there is another example of, well, I use the word defer or delay, or just kind of reconsider a little longer. In this case, the standards for ozone pollution and the attainment and non-attainment zones that go with that. And it's big because Utah and Salt Lake City, the Wasatch Front, are potentially non-attainment zones with respect to ozone. And the EPA has said, well, we're going to spend a little longer looking into the proposed actions that these non-attainment zones will have to take. And so they're extending the review period for another year.
Ozone is an interesting one, I think, for us here in Utah and in Salt Lake, because we talk so much about the particulate matter in the winter and the smog that gets caught in the inversion. But I feel like there isn't as much discussion or buzz about ozone and some of the impacts it can have.
Yeah, I think you're right. It's first of all, it's effectively invisible. It's not like PM 2.5 and PM 10 that has a visual aspect to it. So you see the problem. Ozone is invisible. The concentrations are relatively small. So when people talk about, concentrations are 0.075 micrograms per cubic meter, what does that mean? So, the ozone occurs naturally too, but the ozone also occurs as a result of a mixture of petroleum hydrocarbons being released to the atmosphere, mostly by vehicles, mixing with UV light and creating O3. That's ozone, three atoms of oxygen. So you're right. It doesn't have as great a draw or interest as PM 2.5 and PM 10, but it's a problem.
We also have, I think, tend to have positive associations with it because of all the discussion many years ago about, you know, the ozone layer and how we want to save it and promote it. We want it up there, We don't want it down here.
We want it in the stratosphere, exactly, where it protects us from UV radiation, base radiation. We don't want it in the troposphere, low level, our breathing zone, effectively, because that ozone is very reactive, and it's not good to breathe. Let's put it that way.
Yeah.
So basically, you're right. So this is the ozone in the lowest levels mm-hmm. of the atmosphere, our breathable zones of the atmosphere that they're addressing. But the EPA, not surprisingly, you know, and with respect to at least ozone, and now in the Department of Interior with respect to sage grouse, are looking at things a
right.
Longer
everything's
than
kind
reviewing
of being
things.
Reopened, re-reviewed, delayed,
deferred,
deferred,
defunded, and otherwise. removed, rescinded, if possible. So we're going to talk about Bear's Ears and Ryan Zinke's latest decisions on with respect to that and perhaps the idea of reducing the size of Bear's Ears.
That's right. There was, you know, we've talked on the show, on past shows, about Bear's Ears and the review and the comment period and how Ryan Zinke was responsible for making a recommendation on what to do with Bear's Ears. This past Saturday was the due date for that. And he made a recommendation. It wasn't to, you know, ditch the entire monument, which I think some people feared, but it wasn't good news. We'll put it that way.
All right. So it wasn't the best of news, but now we have someone to talk a little more
about
that.
Now we have an expert.
Yes.
So joining us on the phone now is Alex Terrell. He's the deputy director at the League of Conservation Voters. And he'll be giving us the latest on that report on Bear's Ears National Monument from Secretary Zinke. Alex, thanks for joining us.
Absolutely. Thanks for having me on.
So why don't you start just by telling us a little bit about the background of this. This issue. We've talked about Bear's Ears and the comment and review period that's been taking place. But give us a little context for the report that Secretary Zinke submitted on Saturday.
Sure. So, you know, our national monuments are, you know, these amazing places across the country, everything from you know, the Statue of Liberty, places that protect our kind of natural and cultural heritage, to, you know, the Grand Canyon and Zion, these sorts of places that were first protected as national monuments. So we're talking about very, very special places in our country. And I think because of that, you've never seen any president try to actually abolish a national monument. And what's at risk here as part of this review of national monuments that that President Trump has ordered and that the Interior Department is conducting here is you might see efforts to abolish a national monument or certainly kind of shrink the boundaries of it. And that's the report that we saw yesterday from Secretary Zinke. He wants Trump to shrink the boundaries of a place that holds tremendous value for five tribal nations, you know, in southeastern Utah that came together and have been working for decades to protect places that are really sort of sacred to their culture. These are their ancestral lands. There are pictographs and other sort of archaeological sites all throughout the 1.5 million acres. And so we're just tremendously troubled that we've got a report here from Secretary Zinke to Trump to actually remove some of the protections of this very, very special place, and it's getting tremendous pushback.
Right. Now, there was some thought that, you know, he would just recommend getting rid of this national monument altogether. That was certainly some of the buzz that we were hearing in Utah from some of our local news sources. Is that something you were expecting to see, or were you expecting to see something, you know, more along the lines of what he released?
I think, you know, we didn't know what to expect. And certainly, I think you're right that some of the folks in the Utah delegation were hoping for that kind of an outcome. But I think potentially what's happened here is that, you know, I think there's a recognition that this is a really special place. That there are lots of objects of ecological and archaeological interest in the Bears Ears National Monument. And so those deserve protection. And so I think there was a little bit of a recognition of that. And certainly even Congressman Bishop of Utah had a whole initiative to protect parts of the Bears Ears. And so there is recognition that this is an important place that's worthy of protection. And what you've seen actually is just a real outpouring of support for Bears Ears and other national monuments, with more than a million comments having been submitted to the Interior Department in favor of preserving all of our national monuments. Mm-hmm. And in fact, there was analysis done of the commenters from Utah who self-identified as being either from Utah or from, you know, the Bears Ears region, and 9-1 the comments came in saying, we think Bears Ears should be preserved for future generations as it is. And so right. there has been a lot of pushback.
Right. And that Nell and I are included in those nine.
Full disclosure there. Yeah, yes. Exactly.
Fantastic. Proudly included. Three of us here.
Well, if I recall, the original proposal for the National Monument was to cover roughly 1.9 million acres or so. It got actually reduced to somewhere, I think you said 1.5 or somewhere around that. So it was reduced in its size in the formal proposal. What does this report give a sense of the further shrinking that is being proposed?
Well, that's the thing, is it's a really bare bones report, and I think you're right that, as you mentioned, the tribal proposal was originally for 1.9 million acres, and so I think what the Interior Department under the Obama administration, with Sally Jewell as the Secretary of the Interior, is they really did a big study of the resources of this region. They held public meetings, they did a whole tour, they met with stakeholders of all sides to really identify and look at the language of the Antiquities Act and make sure that they're protecting all of the various kind of objects that are worthy of protection in the monument. And so they got the size that they thought was appropriate and had a bunch of maps and science to justify those boundaries. Mm-hmm. By contrast, the report that Zinke laid out is just a handful of pages, has nothing to do with maps. They haven't done the scientific analysis, or certainly haven't produced it, to justify the kind of recommendation to shrink it down. So we actually have no idea what they want to shrink it down to, or what they would use to justify that. And they need to justify it, because this is any effort to reduce the boundaries or to abolish it is definitely going to get challenged in court, both because there's no language in the Antiquities Act that gives the president the authority to make those changes. They can only protect new public lands as national monuments, but not to undo those protections. There's no language like that. And so that's going to get challenged. But then where you set the new boundaries, if that's where Trump actually ends up taking this and does an executive order to change the boundaries, they're going to have to justify that new boundary in court to make sure that it's protecting the antiquities that are actually included in the new boundaries.
So tell us a little bit more about that legal precedent. I know some presidents have considered this before, considered changing boundaries or making small changes to monuments. And what were the conclusions there?
Yeah, so the fact is that there's no language in the law that allows a president to undo those protections. In the past, in the early days of the Antiquities Act, this is something that was passed back in the Teddy Roosevelt days, 1906, you've had 16 presidents, 8 Republicans and 8 Democrats that have used this authority to protect these majestic public lands and other historical places as national monuments. So a lot of usage of this tool, because these are amazing places. And so in the early days of the Antiquities Act in the 1910s, the 20s, the 30s, you occasionally had presidents that would change some of these boundaries, in part because those sort of early maps back in the day were not as accurate as things are today. And so they did make some of those adjustments. Now, you have not seen in the modern era, I think the last boundary adjustment was back in 1963. You haven't seen any president do anything. And what happened since then was Congress actually passed a law called the Federal Land Policy and Management Act. It really clarified that Congress holds the pen when it comes to changing boundaries of national parks, national monuments, other kind of public land designations. And the Antiquities Act sort of stands as something that the president can do to protect places, but Congress holds the pen if we're talking about changing those designations, right? And so we've not seen a president attempt to do that since that law passed in the 1970s, and we might see that if Trump follows through on Secretary Zinke's recommendation.
We're speaking with Alex Terrell. He's the Deputy Legislative Director at League of Conservation Voters. We're talking about Bears Ears National Monument and a recent report put out this past weekend by the Secretary at the Department of Interior, Ryan Zinke, which suggests that although the National Monument may move forward in its formalizing, it may be smaller in size, among other things, without any kind of quantitative analysis that's being done, which sounds kind of standard operating procedure for this administration and a number of other areas, too. But so where do things go forward now? What is the next step that the DOI performs with respect to this National Monument proposal?
Yeah, so Zinke said that what he's provided is a sort of, kind of interim report. Mm-hmm. And so this overall review of the National Monuments is going to continue. We're right now kind of in a formal public comment period. So listeners can still get their comments into regulations.gov, mm-hmm. as well as a great site called monumentsforall.org, where people can submit a petition in favor of national monuments that will be submitted as a formal public comment. That comment period ends on July the 10th. Right. And then Zinke is going to take all of those comments, hopefully listen to them, because they've been coming in big numbers in favor of national monuments, because, again, these are amazing places. People love their parks. They help fuel a thriving outdoor economy in places like Utah. And so we hope he takes those into account when he does his final report to Trump on all of the post-1996 national monuments that have been designated that's due to Trump on August 24th. And so you're going to continue to see more and more Americans, members of Congress, hunters, anglers, outdoor businesses, the tourism sector, going to continue to weigh in both formally in public comments as well as just, through the press and other media to make their voices known that we really got some really special places that are at risk because of Trump and Secretary Zinke's assault here on public lands. I mean, I think, when you think about that, they're reviewing our national monuments. They're really looking to look at our existing system of public lands and figure out which ones should we be opening up to fossil fuel development. Mm-hmm. They're not looking at, hey, we've got this growing population of Americans. People are tethered to their screens. They need more outdoor spaces. We need more resources to get people for their health and their sanity out into these amazing places that folks in Utah are able to kind of enjoy and just walk out their back doors. They're not looking at that system and saying, like, hey, where can we protect so that we get that growing population outdoors more? And so this is a very just troubling, the whole premise of this review of which places we should get rid of and undo protections for is just hugely problematic. It's an assault on our national parks and monuments.
Right.
And so the League of Conservation Voters is doing everything we can to educate the public about what's at risk in this review.
Right.
Now, obviously, we've been focusing on Bears Ears, and that's really been the one in the spotlight over the past month or so, because we all knew it would be the first to be considered. Talk a little bit about some of the other monuments that you expect to be in the spotlight moving forward with the review of a larger number of monuments.
Yeah.
I would There's assume like Grand
27
Staircase.
27 other national monuments mm-hmm. that are up for review and
right.
like Alex said, are going through public comment period. But yeah, Alex, what others are at more risk than other of these 27 national monuments?
Yeah, for sure. We're tremendously worried, as you mentioned, about Grand Staircase Escalante right near Barrett Ears in southern Utah. I happened to be there a few weeks ago with my family, had never been to Grand Staircase, saw the amazing slot canyons, climbed on the hoodoos. You know, it's a place that would not have been on my radar. I would have gone to Bryce and Zion and these other places, but never gone to a sort of unprotected, Bureau of Land Management landscape like that, were it not a national monument. And there are people like me who are going to these places and driving that tourism sector, when places are protected as national monuments. And so we're very worried about Grand Staircase for sure. I would say another one that we'd be worried about is up in Maine, in the North Woods up there. There's a monument called the Katahdin Woods and Waters. That's a place where you've got what's interesting is Trump and Secretary Zinke have been saying that they're only reviewing the larger landscape national monuments, the places that are over 100,000 acres, to see if we want to get rid of some of them. But they also said, hey, we will also review places where we feel like there was insufficient public input. And so the one that they singled out was the Katahdin Woods and Waters National Monument in Maine. And this is, beautiful North Woods country. It was actually donated. These are private lands that were donated to the National Park Service. So they would have been closed to the public, but this family decided that they want to make a national park and really revitalize the economy up there in northern Maine. And so that's one of the places that's actually been singled out by Secretary Zinke. And what was even more interesting was most of the folks who were at the signing ceremony of this executive order that Trump did to start this review, they were mostly politicians from Utah and other kind of Western states. And lo and behold, standing next to Trump was the governor of Maine, a guy named Paul LePage, who was an early Trump supporter and has sort of been considered kind of a mini Trump, bombastic guy a real ally of President Trump, who has designs on running for the Senate. And so there's a real fear that this will be kind of a political payback that Trump might do to undo that monument that Governor LePage opposed in spite of the economic benefits that we can see from a national park in Maine, which would be the state's first, which would be the first in northern Maine.
Right. Well, we got to wrap up real quick, and we'll remind our listeners again about where they can go to submit their public comments later in the show. What about League of Conservation Voters? Where do people go to learn more about the work you're doing?
Absolutely. Well, we've got a petition up called Monuments. .lcv.org, where people can weigh in, submit an official public comment before July the 10th. We are actually launching a new campaign tomorrow here in Washington, D.C., where I'm calling from with a number of members of Congress from the West, and we're calling it Our Lands, Our Vote, because these are public lands that belong to all of us. And so we're encouraging people to get out and to sort of vote for their public land, sign a petition, talk to your neighbors, make sure that people understand what's at risk when it comes to these national parks and monuments that are under review.
All right.
Well, fantastic. Alex, thanks so much for joining us today.
Absolutely. Thanks for having me on.
Thanks, Alex.
That was Alex Terrell, the Deputy Director at League of Conservation Voters, filling us in on the review of our national monuments and specifically Bears Ears here in Utah.
And like we said, well, at the end of the show, we'll give you another reminder on where you can go to submit your public comments. There's a couple of sites Alex mentioned and we used one ourselves. It's critical. So
we are going to take a quick break, and then we'll be back with Lisa Yoder here to talk Summit County sustainability.
It's This Green Earth. We'll be right back.
Hi, I'm Tom Pettigrew from Park City Mountain and a proud supporter of KPCW. From kids' rope courses to zip lines and hiking trails to the bike park, Park City offers a wide range of family-friendly activities all summer long. More information on new summer activities and all the other programs can be found at parkcitymountain.com.
Hi, I'm Dr. Renato Saltz, proud to support KPCW. At Saltz Plastic Surgeons Pa Vitoria, we offer cosmetic surgeries of the face and body, as well as non-surgical procedures such as CoolSculpting, laser resurfacing, Botox, and fillers. More information at saltzplasticsurgery.com or 655-6612.
Welcome back to This Green Earth, a weekly talk show on environmental issues and concepts of sustainability. I'm Chris Cherniak.
I'm Nell Larson.
You were right. And joining us in studio is Lisa Yoder. She's the, sustainability director for Summit County.
They call me the sustainability manager.
Okay.
We're going to promote you on today's show.
Yeah, on our show, you're the sustainability director. And Lisa comes in periodically to share with us what's going on in the Summit County with respect to sustainability programs and measures and initiatives. And you've got a report you're going to be sharing with County Council next week.
Yes.
Outlining, I guess, this year's programs and measures with respect to the sustainability, your efforts. So let's start here. Give us a quick kind of a rough definition or maybe detailed definition on what sustainability is and maybe what it's not, too. Because it's always a little bit of a challenge to get our heads around that.
Right. A friend of mine calls it a fat word. In other words, it has a lot of meanings to a lot of people.
That's
and
good.
It's really kind of unclear what exactly it is. And, of course, it means a lot of things differently to different departments, for example,
sure.
in the county. But the way I look at it is that it's taking a consideration of economic, social, and environmental, taking a look at all issues through a balanced lens that studies the economic, social, and environmental impact of short-term decisions on the long-term.
Similar to kind of that like triple bottom line people
exactly.
talk about.
Right. Are we making a decision today that we can live with? Well, how will it impact the environment long term? How will it impact social needs long term? And then how can we sustain it economically long term?
Right. So like you say, it's fat because it runs like a thread through many different, well, let's say, departments in the county. You can look at the sustainability of the transportation group. Or sustainability of the economic development group, or
correct.
Sustainability with respect to the environmental group, or the health department, or so. They all
right,
play a role in that.
Right, or take it to a building level. Is it
right.
building? I don't really think of it as, does it have sustainability measures? The question to me is it energy efficient? How is it going to be maintained long term? What are the systems going into it, the impacts of those energy sources long-term, how does that play out?
Okay. So you've got a report coming up.
Yes.
That you for the county. And so what are some of the elements, components that you have in that report that you're going to be sharing with the council?
Well, what I do each year is we quantify the all of the energy consumption and all of the systems, operations, and building functions of the county and determine the emissions associated with all of our operations. So we have several goals, and this report will report out on the progress made on all those goals. But kind of the primary one is emissions reduction. And we achieve that through energy efficiency improvements in buildings, using renewable energy instead of conventional energy, and right-sizing our fleet and using alternative vehicles mm-hmm. in our fleet. So we have been on track, and we are reducing emissions to achieve our goal, which is 13% below business as usual. That was established looking at a trend from 2005 to 2010. Right. And then taking that trajectory, accounting for growth, and taking that out into the future. So that curve, of course, goes up. And then we took 13% below that, and that's our goal. Okay. We're 20% below our goal. So we've more than achieved the goal. However, the concerning part is that while we have been trending downwards each year, the last 2 years, we're starting to trend upward. So while we're investing and we're making great progress, services are growing, demands are growing.
Right.
We have a slight increase in employees.
Right.
We have some new buildings online. We have economic good times, generates
right.
more road projects, mm-hmm. More
right, more infrastructure requirements.
Right, so
water, wastewater.
We've
demand.
Been making great progress, but the trick is going to be how do we accommodate these this growth that the growth in operations and the growth countywide that's impacting emissions.
And so, like you say, it can be kind of a multi-pronged effort in educating users on energy efficiency opportunities, whether that's through improved technology, systems that use advanced technology or mm-hmm. energy-efficient technology, maybe changing behaviors. How about
right.
that? I'm always a fan of people that, just changing their behaviors.
That's a challenging one. It's
that's
easier to put
one.
In some automated light sensors than mm-hmm. to get people to turn off the lights.
That's well, for sure.
We do that every show here at
know,
the Screen
dark
Earth.
In
you
here
come
right
in
now.
Here, it's naturally lit. It's a low carbon footprint show as best possible. But that's examples of changing behaviors.
But Lisa, to your point, I see where you're coming from on that, because changing behaviors takes nonstop education and reminders and, you know, beating people over the head practically to get people to do this, especially in shared facilities. You know, Chris looks skeptical at this point, but I think that in the long run, right, when you have facilities used by hundreds and thousands of people, automating and things along those lines can be super helpful.
Yes, and, okay. and that's the trick, is to balance the investment of capital in technologies, and we are doing that, and we can demonstrate that that is paying off. Our emissions associated with electricity usage are decreasing, and that's where most of our capital improvements have been. They impact reduce electricity consumption.
Okay.
So we're seeing the trends there, and I just lost my train.
speaking of trains or transportation.
Yes.
nice segue.
You had... The county had some natural gas powered cars, vehicles. Do
yes.
you still have that? Are you still planning to say purchase more of those vehicles, or are they going electric? What's the attitude
we
there?
We are using whatever is the most appropriate technology for the vehicle use, and then of course it's balanced with the cost of the vehicle. So we now have 14 vehicles that are fueled alternatively, whether that's electric,
mm-hmm.
natural gas, or let's see, those are in hybrids.
Okay.
So we're replacing, as we replace vehicles,
right.
we look at the use. A natural gas vehicle, we do have, I believe, 8 or 9.
Okay.
And they work really well for certain actually for the Public Works Department, where they have a truck bed where they can put the natural gas tank in the truck.
Right, because it usually holds, it takes up a little more space than a
right.
normal gasoline tank does, or diesel tank.
But the county has installed electric vehicle chargers at, let's see, at the county courthouse mm-hmm. and at the Richens building. We have them slated for the new Camas Library, which is also slated for solar power this year.
Right.
And
it's going to be a green library, as
yes.
I heard. Great.
So the county is doing what we can each year, budget constraints and balancing all of the services and the needs with investing in energy efficiency technology.
More solar panels planned for buildings
yes.
anywhere?
We have solar scheduled to go on the transit center in Kimball Junction and the new Camas Library this
right.
year. And I'm proposing capital projects for... a large solar array on the Richens building next year, and on our public works facility in 2019. And this is all based off a comprehensive study that we did last year to inform us of the prioritizing buildings with the best aspect and the best usage, and you know that make it the most appropriate for those sites. So this is well researched as to which buildings to put solar on,
based on data. We love that.
Right.
So one thing I know that the city is really focusing on for them, pumping water up to some of the really high elevation homes is a huge, huge mm-hmm. consumer of energy for them. Is that as big of an issue for the county, and is that something you're looking at?
I personally have not been tasked with looking at that. Also, the county itself, I'm focused on the county departments within county operations, and the water is managed by the district, Mountain Regional Water Service District.
Right.
And I can assure you that those folks are completely engaged in massive energy efficiency right. measures and incorporating renewable energy and all sorts. They have wizards on electricity usage at Mountain Regional Water.
But does their efforts go into the county's ultimate accounting of the carbon footprint?
No, I only account, I don't account for things in those special service districts.
Oh, okay.
Just the things that county manages directly.
All right.
That's a good question. I don't know how to articulate, other than their special service districts. So I don't do the special service district.
Okay.
So you're essentially at this point just looking at the county-owned facilities versus, you know, everybody who lives in the county and all the activities taking place in the county.
Well, that's the second part of the work. So we have county operations that I focus on,
yeah.
energy efficiency, renewable energy, and transportation.
Okay.
But then we also have community-wide goals. So, Chris, you were involved with us developing the Climate Action Plan
right.
a couple years ago. And that is a countywide goal to reduce greenhouse gas emissions 15% in 15 years.
Right.
So 15% by 2030. Basically, it equates to about 1% per year.
Right. But it's 1% even though there is, like you say, continued growth. And demand for electricity naturally.
We're basing it on a baseline year. I believe it was 2014.
Right. So 15% below 2014. So you're going to have to reduce more than 15% to account for the natural mm-hmm. growth that goes on as more people move here, more businesses here. So it's a challenge. That's what you say right now. And with it, you know, prosperous economy that uses a lot of. That has a big carbon footprint associated with that, and so it's a challenge.
Well, and we've made great strides there, too,
yeah.
with, as you know, Summit Community Power Works,
yeah.
that whole two-year initiative. We're waiting to find out if we've won the prize, the Georgetown University Energy Prize.
Literally.
Yes. So we've reduced energy there. We've quantified it, not as much as we wanted, but we're reducing energy.
But it's a start. It's a good start.
At the municipal and residential sector. And through that program with Mountain Town Community Solar, we installed over 1 megawatt of solar this year
mm-hmm.
in residents and properties in the county. But the real challenge I'm facing and I'm bringing to council next Wednesday, we are making great progress. We are doing tremendous things throughout the community, but we're not really moving the needle. That was the reason for the Georgetown Energy
right.
Prize competition.
Right.
What does it take to really move the community and move the needle to reduce energy consumption and consequently reduce emissions? So the Climate Action Group reconvened. We recognize we need to do a better job of messaging. Our actions, our individual actions, make a difference. Our cars are adding to the emissions and impacting our air quality. Some people associate air quality but not emissions and climate change.
Right.
When we don't turn off the lights, when we leave the window open because we want air in the house but the furnace is on.
Right. When we use too much water because
right.
water is definitely equates to energy here.
So these are all small things, and voluntary measures can can do a lot, and we can demonstrate they're doing, they're making progress. But, or and, it's getting, it's going to be more challenging, and it may require some more bold initiatives, similar perhaps to Park City's 100% renewable energy goal.
Right.
If you really want to move the needle on reducing emissions from electricity usage, you have to change the source of the electricity supply. If we really want to move the needle on emissions from associated with buildings, which is about 38% of the emissions in the county operations and countywide, we're going to have to do some significant changing in the way we build buildings and make improvements to existing buildings possible and easy and readily available to people. So we have some big challenges ahead of us.
Right, and that's what the Climate Action Plan is attempting to address.
Yes, it is.
In your plans. Okay.
And it sounds like you have some big ideas on that front about how some of those things might be changed.
Well, I have some ideas, yeah. Yes.
And that's what you'll be sharing next week with council, perhaps?
Yes, I'll be sharing the results, more the data.
Oh, okay.
And more concrete, you know, what we did on each of the 8 objectives in the 2014 to 2016 sustainability plan. We also had a 24 to 2016 energy efficiency plan for the buildings. So we're wrapping up those 3-year plans. And you're reporting on the overall outcome, which is as pretty much what I just described.
Okay. So that's not tomorrow, but the following Wednesday?
June 21st.
June 21st, county council meeting. It'll be on the agenda if people want to learn more about it.
Right. And my staff report and my annual report will be on the attached to the agenda.
Posted on the agenda. Okay.
So you mentioned Park City. You know, Park City also has some pretty bold goals. How closely do you guys work together on these sustainability type of initiatives?
We work really closely together. Luke and I get together frequently. Hmm. We're on some of the, we've studied community renewable energy, what it would take to get Park City Municipal, what it would take to get Summit County jurisdiction to provide 100% renewable energy. We meet regularly and discuss, you know, more nuanced daily activities. We share the same measurement systems on emissions. My staff is working with Luke's staff to make sure that we're reporting in the same way so that we can, you know, as Park City reports, that contributes to our goal. Mm-hmm. We're contributing to their goals, so we're trying to align our measuring systems the same. Yeah, we work
really closely together. Yes. Yeah. Well, it seems good to only make sense, of course.
Right, and they're good people to work with.
Once again, power of the collective, mm-hmm. Right?
Yes.
Power of the collective impacts has a force multiplier effect on getting education and outreach and awareness out to residents and businesses on how they can save energy. And if more people were like me and just kind of sat in stunned silence in the dark at their house and didn't do anything.
That's right, in the cold, in the dark.
And analyze their heat tape usage and hot tub electricity usage.
Exactly. And save like $50, $60 a month on my electric and natural gas bill. That's real money to me,
right,
at least. It made a difference to me, mm-hmm, in changing that behavior and just paying attention. Mm-hmm. To where my carbon footprint is.
And so, I turned off my hot tub this year.
Perfect. Thank you, Lisa. Decommissioned it.
I did.
Well,
tired
done.
Of it.
So, well, I'll be curious to see what kind of savings you see on your electric bill on that. Lisa Yoder, we got to run. Website, the information on the county website, you have a
sustainability. SummitCounty.org/sustainability.
Okay. And again, you'll be giving your report at the next Wednesday's county council meeting.
Correct.
Look for that agenda. Thanks again, Lisa, for coming on.
And, you're welcome.
We'll have you back on for an update in another 6 months or so.
Great. Perfect. Thank you both very much.
All right. Let's take a break for a couple underwriters and come back. We got a reminder, one news item or so to squeeze in, right? You bet. It's This Green Earth. We'll be right back.
Support for KPCW programming has been provided by the Southern Utah Wilderness Alliance, a nonprofit organization dedicated to protecting Utah's remaining Red Rock Wilderness lands.
Suwa, and Utah's Red Rock Wilderness need your support now more than ever. To learn more about how you can become involved, please visit the Suwa website at suwa.org.
Miller Orthodontics supports KPCW and their involvement with area youth and teens. Speaking of youth, did you know Invisalign has a specific type of aligner just for teens? Over 3/4 of our Invisalign patients are 19 or younger. More information about Invisalign Teen is available at m2ortho.com.
Welcome back to This Green Earth. We got a few minutes. We want to give our folks a reminder now. What is that?
Very important. Chris is very focused
next
on the reminder.
On a very important This Green Earth. We have a reminder for you on how you can submit your public comments on the national monuments that remain under review from the Department of Interior. Now, I submitted my comments on bears, ears, and all the national monuments. I went to regulations.org.
.gov. Regulations.gov.
You're right. Thank you.
Critical reminder.
Regulations.gov. And they have a great website. It's easy to submit your comments. Now, Alex said that that you could still submit comments to Bears Ears. I thought they closed.
They have reopened along with this extension or continued to keep it open.
So you
along
can submit
this.
Comments mm-hmm. to Bears Ears and all the other national monuments mm-hmm. in one big comment. Mm-hmm. But it's
and
important
to get
Utah,
it in. And if you live in Utah, identify yourself as a Utah.
And kids, you can submit comments too. There's no minimum age. Anybody can submit comments. And like they say, it was running 9-1 just for the Utah residents. And it was running, didn't we do an informal poll? It was like 96-98% mm-hmm. of the comments, this is back weeks ago, were running in favor of keeping these national monuments in Bears Ears. So that's regulations.gov. And he also mentioned monuments.org, Monuments for All. And the League mm-hmm. of Conservation Voters has ways that you just go to their website and they'll direct you to how you can submit comments.
Yep, a lot of these other groups will pass your comments along if you comment through them as well.
All right. So we got that. Oh, we got another. I got it.
Chris, you have to tell us right. about
kids,
the most interesting summer job.
Summer job. You need a summer job this year. You want to be outdoors. You want to help the environment. You want to make some money. Well, first you have to go to Florida. Secondly, you have to go to South Florida.
In the summer.
And you can work in the Everglades catching Burmese pythons. Now, Florida is hiring more python hunters and expanding the areas where they can stalk the invasive snakes, because these snakes have effectively will eat everything from mice to alligators.
They've largely removed
they are
all
apex predators,
mammals, all animals.
Yeah,
from these
anecdotally, there are very few four-legged animals left in the Everglades. And that throws everything out of balance. We could talk more about how the impacts. But the Water Management District, the South Florida Water Management District, started paying minimum wage to hunters back in March to kill pythons just in Miami-Dade County. They killed about 158, but they need to kill a lot more. So if you're interested in making $8.10 an hour and bonuses, because you get $50 for a four-foot snake, an additional $25 for every foot after that. So if you get a 10-footer, which is not uncommon, that is what? 150. That's like $200 for a 10-foot python. So
all right, go hone your python hunting skills.
Do you have staff that needs some?
Save the environment.
Nail the staff.
Save the world.
Your staff
yeah, exactly.
needs something to do. Send them to Florida and hunt Burmese pythons. It's an amazing problem they have down there. So,
we got to wrap up.
Let's thank our underwriters. You go. I have to get our music.
All right. We'd like to thank Recycle Utah, Republic Services, Southern Utah Wilderness Alliance, Vail Epic Promise, Berkshire Hathaway Home Services, San Francisco Design, Park City Mountain, and listeners like you.
You can always join us on Facebook at KPCW This Green Earth, or email us your thoughts, comments, and ideas at thisgreenearth@kpcw.com.